Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station. Live from the corner of Broadway and Battery, this is the Damon Bruce Show on 95.7 The Game. Now, Damon Bruce.
Can't do it.
Not Damon Bruce. Damon Bruce, reveling in the birth of his child. Not regaling, not recanting, not recounting.
Not recalcitrant.
Definitely not recalcitrant, which is one of the words that we learned today.
He may have turned already, because that day is coming.
It's Ray Ratto, it's Ryan Covey, and it is Matt Kolsky. And we appreciate your patronage here on a Monday afternoon as you're driving across the Bay Bridge, and we'll be here at 6 o'clock when you get over to the other side. You're welcome. All right, I wanted to ask you, and I know Kolsky, you were living in Chicago in 1989.
I was.
What?
Well, Evanston, Illinois.
Okay,
in
Evanston, Illinois.
But close enough.
Okay, so what do you remember from that time? I know you grew up as a big baseball fan.
Yeah, if you're asking about the quake, what I remember is that it happened. And okay, that's more or less it. I was 8 years old in Chicagoland watching the World Series, but not registering it in any meaningful way. And I've erased most of my memories over time. So very little in my memory other than it happened. And the fact that it happened was a huge deal.
Were you at the stick, Ray,
that night? I was at the ballpark.
Yeah, I figured you would be. What do you remember from that night specifically? I mean, what stands out to you the most?
Oh, about 1,000 things.
Sure, yeah.
But mostly how many people were, and this is people who had lived here a long time, were like frozen and then started to look for the exits. Because they just said, well, we're all going to die if I don't get out to a hospitality tent and start drinking now. Yeah. And me, because I'm an idiot, I went just the other way. I ran through the stands to get down on the field to talk to players for a story that I was going to have to file at some point, even though there was no electricity in the city. So, yeah, I just tunnel visioned it. You know, I mean, I thought about, you know, my wife lived across, you know, in Alameda. And, you know, so I hope she got home all right, fortunately. And this is the one weird thing that stands out is the Chronicle phone in the press box was the only one in the press box that worked.
Wow.
Because I guess it was wired differently than all the others. I don't know why, but it did. So I was able to call my cousin and say, will you make sure she's okay? And she was. But the rest of the night, I'd be up writing. And every 20 to 30 minutes, a cop would come in and say, hey, you've got to clear out of here. And I would say, hey, have you talked to your wife yet? My phone works. And that worked about 4 times.
Yeah, letting them call their families.
Right.
And then so
and
you
then
bought
they said, you got
time.
10 more minutes, and then right, they disappear. And then I didn't get out of the ballpark till about 9:30, and I didn't get home until about 12:30 because I had to drive all the way down through San Jose in pitch dark until you get to, like, the other side of San Mateo.
Had they closed the Dumbarton and the San Mateo Bridge?
Yes.
So those were all closed now.
Yeah, so I was going to have to drive by land.
Right, so you drove all the way down to San Jose and then back up 880 to
right,
Alameda.
Yeah.
Wow. And those bridges to Alameda, obviously, they kept those open?
Well, yeah, because they weren't, you know, they weren't vital
structures
to traffic.
Sure, but, yeah. I mean, if you live on Alameda, they're kind of vital to you because, like,
boy,
that's
I tell
your
you, they create some traffic when they get screwed up, right? It's
yeah,
mess up your whole day over there.
Bridges go up, for sure.
I'm curious if you remember anything from after you got down to the field. Were there any players who said anything particularly noteworthy to you?
They were all sort of slack-jawed, scared.
I'm sure.
The ones who lived in the area, and there were only a few, but Dave Stewart stood out. He was absolutely unfazed.
Because lived
He's
through
been
earthquakes.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd done this.
I talked to him. I interviewed Dave Stewart about a year ago and asked him about that. And he said that was his thing. I mean, he was just, he said, well, it wasn't anything new. He knew it was severe. We knew it was a big one.
I mean, all we were hearing was that, you know, the marina's on fire, you know, thousands dead in the collapse of the freeway. And the marina was on fire, but not as badly as they said. And the collapse of the freeway, and this is the most amazing part of all, is that rush hour traffic, 60 people died, not what you would figure
thousands
would have happened if the freeway had collapsed during a real rush hour. And in that way, the World Series saved thousands of lives because people either stayed where they worked, they were going to just watch the game at a local tavern, or they went home early.
Right. Man, I had never thought of that.
And that's been a narrative that's been out there for a long time because that stretch of the Cypress structure, I mean, you know, double-decker freeway.
Yeah.
And for those that don't know, you know, maybe you're a little younger, my dad took me to check out that whole thing afterwards. That's kind of where West Oakland BART is. Like, if you're going on the 980, you know, towards Alameda and you turn to the left there, kind of where downtown Oakland's off to your left, that area to the right, that used to be where that freeway connected, and that's where the Cypress structure was. It always kind of struck me, Ray, that there's no, like, marking there that denoted what happened there or that, you know, was it 60 people passed away there? There's nothing that says, like, the Cypress structure once stood here and it was the site of a, you know, a devastating scene from the Loma Prieta earthquake.
Yeah, there's nothing that I know of anywhere.
Yeah, and I just always thought that was a little weird, like, because, I mean, a lot of people lost their lives there and you think that you maybe want to have some kind of, you know, commemorative, I don't know, plaque or something.
I don't know. Apparently not.
Yeah. But I just, what I remember, and it absolutely hits home your point. So, we're Cubs fans in my house, right? So we just got finished, you know, what, a week and a half earlier watching Will Clark eviscerate the Cubs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the chances that we'd get to see, you know, Jerome Walton and Andre Dawson play in a World Series, okay, did not happen.
Yeah, Jerome Walton was a big name at our house.
Yeah, no doubt. He was, man. I love me some Jerome Walton. But anyway, so I'm out front waiting for my dad to get home from work so we can watch the World Series because we're still huge baseball fans and, you know, in our house in El Sobrani. And I remember that same thing where just couldn't wait for the start of the World Series. It's the Battle of the Bay. I remember, you know, obviously the first thing you think of even at my young age was, you know, how horrible you felt for the people, you know, who were truly affected by this. But once you got, you know, from just purely a sports level, you know, you felt like I felt bad for the A's players in particular who had lost the World Series in 88 to the Dodgers, a team that they absolutely should have beaten. They finally punch through and win that World Series. Obviously, they got swept by the Reds the next year. But the one year where they finally actually got the job done, when let's face it, that team probably should have won three World Series, at least two. The only one that they did win was, you know, a footnote, an afterthought because of all the other horrible stuff that happened in the Bay Area. So, you know, it's minuscule in the grand scheme of things, but it always kind of stood out to me.
But the two they lost were their fault.
Without question.
So, I mean, and the one they won, you know, nobody much remembers except for the earthquake. But I remember very distinctly that the day after the quake, the A's were proactive about thinking about when the series was going to resume by leaving and going to Phoenix and getting away from it all. The Giants largely stayed here and were just inundated day after day with earthquake news because that's all there was.
Yeah.
And I don't think they would have won a game in that series because the A's were infinitely better. But the Giants weren't prepared to resume playing. I think if Faye Vincent had said the series is over, we're giving it to Oakland, they might have bitched for about 20 minutes and that was about it.
Yeah. Do you think they made the right decision playing those games out?
I don't know if it made any difference one way or the other. I know that waiting 10 days allowed the people in charge of infrastructure in the Bay Area some time to reassemble whatever passed for normalcy. Mm. Because either way, the earthquake was going to take months, if not years, to fix.
Quick note. The Cypress Freeway Memorial Park does exist in Oakland, 14th and Mandela.
Okay. Yeah. I've been down there before and I've tried to, you know, because I know exactly where it was and I've never seen anything there. You know, I could be mistaken. I mean, I park at West Oakland sometimes, but I don't spend a ton of time down there. But I have actually looked around before to see if there's anything that says it.
The Cypress Freeway Memorial Park is what it's called.
Oh, okay, cool. All right.
It is, based on the pictures, rather small and not totally impressive, but it does exist.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, maybe, I don't know. I just always felt like there should have maybe been a little something more then. You know, because it's not, certainly it's not something that stands out to you when you drive through there. I can promise you that.
And it's obviously a huge event.
Yeah, no doubt. But and also, you know, the thing that I remember too was I was so proud, like, of the way that everybody in the Bay Area reacted, right? I mean, you see the best in people during the worst times, you know? And I just felt like the Bay definitely banded together. And it was crazy to me as a young kid, like, all eyes in the world are on the Bay. You know, they were already on the Bay because of the World Series and then everything that happened afterwards. But, hey, we kept moving, right? We kept rolling.
Yeah. I don't think you could have done much better.
No doubt.
Or much else.
Right. What else are you going
to
do?
No doubt about that. All right. Coming up a little bit later on, we had a chance to talk to Barry Zito, speaking of the Battle of the Bay. And we had a really fun conversation with Barry. So we're going to roll that out for you. If there's anything you'd like to get into, 888-957-9570 is the number. Chilton Autobody text line, 957-95. You got the A's and the Giants tomorrow. 49ers got a preseason game in the books, albeit kind of an ugly one. Same thing with the Oakland Raiders. I love it, Kolsky, when you were driving in the call today, take it up for the Raiders.
Yeah.
This is the problem with preseason right
yeah,
here.
I heard someone call in and say, I can't believe people think the Niners are going to win 8 or 9 games. They barely beat the Cowboys. Rams are way better than the Cowboys, and the Raiders whoop that ass. And 14-3, it's a stretch to call that a blowout. And also, literally nobody's starters are playing. What are we talking about?
Right.
Yeah, there's ass that's worth whooping and ass that's worth leaving alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, you fade.
I mean, but there's none in the preseason that's worth whooping. None.
You keep saying that, and yet you're still fascinated by it. And that's the most interesting thing to me, is that you guys know in your heart that this is all nonsense, but you like the nonsense too much to give it up. And hats off to you.
That's somewhat true. But I would also point out that neither Ryan nor I have put any stock in actual points or final scores of preseason games. We're just doing our best to read between the lines and find things of value that we can take out of them.
Which, coincidentally,
all I'm going to say is
the job.
Yeah,
I just want to throw that in there.
Well,
sports talk show host.
For you guys, that's fine. I'll fake it.
You can do the satire thing. I know. How you roll.
This isn't satire. This is truth.
Yeah.
They both covered. And nobody has
Did
mentioned
they?
That. Yes.
I didn't know the spreads.
Well,
which I do take as a point of pride.
I don't think that's good at all. Because without gambling, football would just be dogfighting.
You care about the spread of a preseason game.
No, I just know it.
Okay. All right.
That's my job.
All right.
It's my job to know what the line was and how many penalties there were.
All right. By the way, I did my job.
You do yours.
Okay.
You care about these guys who are going to be in the Canadian Football League in 2 weeks. I will care about this.
There's some really good stories, though.
CFL wide receiver the Niners signed a couple years ago.
And what about Damon Sheehy Giuseppe? We got to keep an eye on him as well.
Sheehy
our
Giuseppe.
Favorite preseason story. All right. Coming up on the other side, we'll regale more tales of preseason football with Ray Ratto and Matt Kolsky and Ryan Covey. I'm sorry? Oh, we don't break here. Oh, 125. That's right. See, I knew that. So we're going to do it right now. We're just, you know what, Ray? We don't even need to take a break. We're literally going to talk about it right now. So you're welcome. Kyle Shanahan, by the way, on the penalties, which there were quite a few of them. How about 18 for 216? He was not a happy coach.
Of course it bothers you. We'll look at him very hard tomorrow. Anytime you have a game where you have 18 penalties, another team has 5. We should look at it hard. I mean, it's very hard to win that way. It was very frustrating. But, you know, we'll look at them hard and see if all of them were stuff that we can control.
Look at them hard?
Boy, if you want...
What?
What?
Sorry.
Take a hard look at them.
We're going to take a good long look at them. All right. Thanks, Coach.
Being robbed of the right to make fun of Alex Dickerson's name is really
so
useful.
Child.
Easy, totally Dewey lost Cox.
My, totally lost my train of thought.
Sorry, Elena.
Sorry, Elena.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
That wasn't my fault that time.
It's always your fault, Ray.
Okay, fair enough.
On some level.
I get that completely. 41 minutes.
With the hijinks that ensue, especially in the 5 o'clock hour.
I was just going to say.
Oh, you're back now?
Before
back
I was so confusingly interrupted. That the whole, the second number he gave you there, the 5, if you were hoping to blame the 18 penalties, at least in part, on overly litigious referees, the 5 is not a great number for you.
Right.
Because you'd imagine if they were just calling everything, it would be more like 15 to 15 than 18 to 5. Again, though, of all the things I'm not worried about after for the first preseason game, penalties is near the top of the list. Because it's just, it's everybody's first preseason game, if you catch my meaning.
Absolutely. One guy that really kind of stood out to me, fellas, and instinctual would be the way that I would describe him. Fifth round pick, Dre Greenlaw out of Arkansas. I mean, I think, look, Malcolm Smith hasn't shown the ability to stay on a football field throughout his 49ers career, so there's that. I know Elijah Lee looked pretty good last year. You're hoping Quan Alexander can be a big part of things, and Fred Warner was basically the most consistent player that you had on defense, save for Richard Sherman and DeForest Buckner last year.
Certainly your best rookie last year.
Without question. And Greenlaw, he can play the will. We know that on the weak side linebacker, but sounds like he can play some Sam as well. And if Malcolm Smith isn't going to be healthy, and what have we seen from this dude to ever believe that he is going to be healthy?
Nothing.
I think that Dre Greenlaw is going to have a part to play. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Malcolm Smith didn't make the team, and if Dre Greenlaw continues to flash as he has in camp and look pretty good in the first preseason game, I think they would love to give this guy an opportunity.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's conceivable based on Malcolm Smith's contract. They did restructure it, I know, at the end of last year, so I'm guessing they got to pay him anyway. So I'm guessing he'll be on the team. But first of all, as you said, he's not likely to be healthy. Second of all, he's certainly not going to be an elite Pro Bowl level guy at that position. So if you've got two young guys in Lee and Greenlaw who could play that position, I think you'll just end up seeing less and less of Malcolm Smith, which should be a good thing for the Niners defense.
Yeah, maybe they don't cut him, but
yeah, I just don't know that you can. And I say that I literally don't know. Maybe they can. I'd have to look up the.
Well, it's kind of like Jerick McKinnon.
Contract.
It's not like for this particular season they're up against a salary cap anyway, so it's not like they need the cap relief going
with
forward.
The,
though
with the way they're going through injuries, wouldn't hurt to keep the depth. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That being said, anything that puts Malcolm Smith further down the depth chart should probably be a good thing in the mind of 49ers fans. And whether that's Elijah Lee, whether that's Dre Greenlaw, I think it's also worth noting Quan Alexander, while they want him out there and expect him to be healthy for the regular season, has not yet done much, even in practice. So this might be depth you need on day one.
No.
On the Will side. I mean, you may not have a chance to try him in another spot. So look, anytime you find a guy in the fifth round who looks like he's a legitimate NFL player already, it's a huge win. Huge win.
Yeah, and right now he's mostly playing strong side.
Sorry, I switched him.
Yeah, you're good. No, I'm just right now he's mostly playing strong side. He does play, he plays weak side in the nickel, where, I've talked to some people that said he's a pretty good fit there.
So that would be him and Warner in the nickel, I'm guessing?
Yeah, and so he'll still need to prove he can hold up as the weak side in the wide nine scheme that they're running. So the wide nine, get ready for that, 49ers fans. We're going to hear a lot about the wide nine. Ray, you up on your wide nine knowledge?
I don't want to have any knowledge of the wide nine. I think I think more globally.
You're more of a big picture guy?
Well, like big picture as in show me all 16 games. I don't need to know who's playing the wide nine on any given moment.
All right, fair
enough.
When
they drafted Greenlaw, for the record, all of the sort of pre-draft scout work on him suggests he could play literally any linebacker position. He was a team captain at, what was it, South Carolina, Arkansas.
Yeah.
And he is a guy who moved from inside to outside at Arkansas and they believe can play any linebacker position in the pros. So for whatever it's worth, I feel like if things go really well, he's sort of your backup at all three linebacker spots when the season starts.
If he's any good, he plays all three at once.
I mean, he hopefully.
Patrick Willis certainly did.
Yeah. Chilton Out-of-Body text line, 95795. Outside of Bosa, which I think we all hope is a real impact player, not an impact rookie, but an impact player in the league, between Hurd and Samuel and Dre Greenlaw, and let's face it, the once touchbacked Mitch Wisnowski, which rookie are you most excited about seeing on the field, and which one gave you the most to think about over the weekend? Let's hear from Kyle Shanahan on Dre Greenlaw, who, as I said, he's been turning some heads.
I mean, it's shown up that way in camp, too. You know, he's always seemed to be around the ball in the run game and the pass game. From what I saw, he made a few plays out there, and I'm sure I'll see a little more when I watch the tape, but seemed pretty encouraging how he played tonight.
So as a guy who grew up a Bears fan, and you're in the same boat on this, and has spent my professional career watching 49ers football an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm familiar with good linebacker play.
Me too.
And I feel like it often shows up this quickly when a guy is really going to be great.
For sure. It's instinctual.
I think of when Lance Briggs came to the Bears. Because you had Urlacher at that point, and they'd been kind of looking for someone to be the guy next to Urlacher.
When Roosevelt Colvin left for the Patriots, mm-hmm. there was a huge void.
The great pass rusher, Roosevelt Colvin. And then when Briggs arrived, you knew it that preseason. That this was it. And I'm not saying Dre Greenlaw is Lance Briggs. But what I am saying is the guys who constantly show up around the ball end up being the good linebackers in this league. And you pretty much see it year one, if not day one.
But I also think that's true at a lot of positions.
Yeah.
It's definitely true at running back. Mm-hmm. I think it's true at wide receiver. I think quarterbacks can grow into their gig a little bit.
Yeah, linemen grow into them a little bit
more.
Well,
I mean...
Corners.
Yeah, I mean, you can get cuffed around in the secondary a bit and then grow. But I think more often than not, when you look at a guy who, quote, has to be coached up, he's a fringe guy for his career. The guys who make impacts at almost all positions hit the ground running. And maybe it's because they went to the right school before and got coached up there. Or maybe they are just great physical specimens yeah. who can do all the things good football players of that position need to do. I think for the most part, for all we talk about, you know, training camp, this training camp, that, the guys who set themselves on fire early are the ones you see from farthest away.
And speaking of some guys that did show some promise in their first preseason game, Jalen Hurd, couple of touchdowns. Debo Samuel had that nice catch, basically just jumped over a DB and just took it away from him.
He was also wide open.
Underthrown.
And really, was that the one? He also drew a pass interference call on one play. And again, preseason football, what do you know?
Sure, but I gotcha.
It felt like he was running wide open more than anybody else in that game. To the point where it was noticeable how often he was getting free of his coverage.
All right, well, here's what Kyle Shanahan said about Debo Samuel.
Similar to college and how he's been since he's gone to practice, the game's just it's not too big for Debo. He's very competitive. He's a good wide receiver, but he's one of the more physical guys out there. We wanted to get him. We got him a run on a round where you could see a little bit of his physicality. Very similar to Jalen. Their bodies are a little bit different, but same type of mentalities.
If I asked you,
what if I
to list all of the words you might use to describe Dante Pettis, Marquise Goodwin, Trent Taylor, Richie James, and Kendrick Bourne, physical is probably the first word that you'd be like, yeah, definitely not going to say
that. Not those guys.
It is not a coincidence that the two receivers they drafted in the second and third rounds of this draft are both guys who like to put their hands on the opposition and create some physical contact. That is something that, even more so than the height, physicality has been sorely lacking in Niners receivers. And I would go so far as to say, while George Kittle is a pretty good blocker, I don't even think of him as physical once he's out on a route. I think of him as a speed receiver.
It's a finesse football team.
Yeah.
Like, across the board, but particularly
the running backs, too.
Yeah, there's no running back. They don't have a banger.
Except Juszczyk.
Yeah, they might as well call him Never Use Check because they don't ever use him.
Hold on, seriously. Wait a second.
Can I get one? Hey-o! I mean, seriously, they are a finesse football team until further notice.
Well, other than the first couple of years of the Walsh era, when were they not?
Harbaugh?
Frank Gore?
They pounded that. It was a defensive run first,
yeah,
pound the ball.
Right. But for the most part, the last 40 years of 49er football, have basically been offense first. And I don't want to say finesse defense, but
they had some dudes that could bring some nasty defense, though.
But not many. I mean, it was more technique. It was more, I mean,
Ronnie Lott.
I said, other than the first couple of years of the Walsh years. I mean, but
no, I think that tracks for me. You think of the Niners as an offensive team in the same way you think of the Bears as a defensive team or what have you.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and the Jets is a god-awful team.
Right, yes, and certain teams as cursed and other teams as living charmed lives. Certainly the Niners, the first thing you think is offense.
Let me just get to this quickly because this the one position battle that's going to really go down to the end, I think, is at wide receiver. They got a lot of different options, none of them elite, but there are a lot of guys in the conversation. One guy you can check off the list for the time being, Trent Taylor. Here's what he said, Coach Shanahan, about his injury.
Yeah, definitely. And him also. You know, he was having a hell of a camp, and it was disappointing to hear. But fortunately, it won't be the year. You know, I think that's about 4 weeks from week one. It's usually a 4 to 6 week injury, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, 6 to 8 weeks for Trent Taylor, the official word, with a Jones fracture. And Richie James, we know, can make some plays in the slot. Dante Pettis can make some plays in the slot. So it'll be an opportunity for some other guys in the slot and on special teams. Because it sounds like Garoppolo and Taylor had a lot of chemistry. Maybe a positive that comes out of this is Pettis and Garoppolo get some much-needed chemistry built up as the 49ers. They're going to do some joint practices with the Broncos this week from Denver. So there you go.
This, Ray, are we allowed to mention injury proneness?
It's not my show. Mention whatever you want.
Your name's on the
marquee.
It's
as much your
baby.
Show as anybody.
Yeah. You need to know that.
I really reject that.
You I'm just saying.
I don't want my name dragged through the mud with this.
You did see.
Yes.
I'll ask you when we get back.
All right. Well, on the other side, we're going to replay our interview with Barry Zito. If you missed that, he's got a book coming out. So stick around, and then we will let Kolsky ask Ray the million-dollar question. So don't you dare go anywhere. In the meantime, what's up, Elaine? Any news on my wallet?
Now, back to the Damon Bruce Show on 95.7 The Game.
Joining us now on the dial pad guest line, Barry Zito, Cy Young Award winner and two-time World Series champ with the San Francisco Giants. Of course, dial pad helps you make smarter calls. Barry's got a new book coming out. It's called Curveball. Yeah, that 12-6 curveball, something that baseball fans will long remember. It'll be available September 17th, 2019, barnesandnoble.com and other places awesome books are sold. Barry, what's going on, man? How you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Just hanging out in Nashville. How are you guys doing?
Doing awesome. Hey, so let's just start with the motivation and the inspiration to write the book. Just talk to us. I mean, we know you've lived a very fascinating life.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, I think on one term it was kind of maybe a selfish motive to just have the release of almost saying the stuff that you can't really say in media interviews. Hmm. And, you know, I mean, you guys know more than anyone, you kind of, after games and when things aren't going right, you don't always get the full story. So I think for me it was cathartic to kind of give the full story, even if it just gives me that release. Because, you know, there was a lot of turbulent times, and I tried to say the right thing and did most of the time, I think. But there's just some other stuff going on, I think, with most professional athletes that they don't lead on to when they're trying to appear a certain way, I guess, you know.
When did you decide that you had to write the book, if only for you, and how long did it take?
I hooked up with a manager out here in Nashville who actually has been helping me a lot with the music stuff, but he always had this vision, you know, that I could write a book and just kind of tell the things in my own way. And so that was kind of the impetus. And it took about 2 years front to back. I mean, it was a ton of work, you know, definitely worth it, but a whole lot of work. I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
So looking at just the sort of summary of what the book is about, there seems to be a decent amount about just your frame of mind and some of the struggles you went through from a mental, emotional standpoint. And it's been a big story for about a year in the NBA that the commissioner said he's worried about players not being happy enough. And I'm wondering if you just think in general, whether it's MLB specifically or sports leagues in general, if more needs to be done, A, for mental health and people with real mental health issues, but also just for guys who may not have a serious mental health issue, but, you know, people, everyone's going through some stuff.
It is, you know, and I think that's something, too, that it's important. I mean, it was good for me to kind of do it, but it's also important, I think, for people to understand that, you know, we're all trying to work our hardest, right, to be successful and to achieve these things in life. And I think a lot of us, at least as kids, were under the impression that these things are going to really fill us up, you know, and give us this lasting fulfillment. And, you know, this is what I've dreamed of my whole life. But, you know, as you guys know, when you do have those moments, they're fleeting. It feels great, you know, but it's kind of like that quick spark, that firecracker that burns out. And then you're kind of like back to, okay, I'm back at my baseline. I've achieved these things, but I still want to achieve these things. And so it's kind of just telling the story from, you know, I guess from the other side of the rainbow is like, hey, man, you know, there's some good things with achieving all this. But when you're looking for everlasting happiness and kind of that pot of gold, so to speak, it's not really there. And, you know, so that's kind of what the story's about, because, you know, I place so much of my identity on my success and my failures. And I think if I had a little perspective going in, which I didn't really have at all, I had to earn my perspective through tough times as a Giant. But I think I would have handled things much differently in my career had I kind of read a book like this, let's say, going in.
But in learning perspective, what was the moment when you sort of had that epiphany? And maybe it was just in the rearview mirror, but when did you feel like, you know what? It's okay that I didn't get it before because I get it now.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, for me, I was so attached to, you know, the highs and lows, right? So if I pitched good, I was a good person. And I'd be like out on the town, like hanging out in coffee shops, like, hey, you know, who can I sign an autograph for today? And if I pitched bad, I would literally stay in my, you know, my flat in San Francisco until it was time to go to the park. And so the perspective that I got was, oh, I'm actually more than my performance, which is kind of a hard thing to disassociate from when you're a professional athlete and you're under this impression that everyone's kind of thinking about you and these articles are being written, right? So it ends up like the world's revolving around you. But in reality, people have their own issues and they're going, you know, they're taking care of their families and they're not thinking about you every day. But I think as athletes, we get duped into thinking it is all about us. And that mindset does serve us to, you know, to achieve success in the first place. So it can really come back to bite you. And so that's kind of the perspective for me, was getting left off the roster in 2010 and being like, okay, they didn't even need me and they just did this amazing thing. So maybe it's not about me at all.
Talking to Barry Zito, his memoir, Curveball, coming out September 17th. It's Ryan Covey, Matt Kolsky, and Ray Rout. A couple more minutes here with Barry. So, yeah, walk me through 2010. And, you know, in 2012, and we'll talk about that in a moment, the vindication was incredible. Obviously, what a story. But walk me through 2010 and just, you know, your mindset. I'm sure, you know, obviously you want to be out there pitching and helping the team, but there was also, you know, a part to play behind the scenes, whatever way that you could contribute. Just, and I'm sure that was, you know, a tough time for you to not be able to be on the roster. Just kind of walk me through that and, you know, how that changed you personally and how it motivated you in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, and the book touches on this, I didn't really have a great foundation of what was important and what wasn't coming into baseball in general, right? So I came in with this whole idea that it was all about me, you know, if I can think it and dream it, then I can achieve it. So I kind of thought I could control the world and, you know, and certainly opposing hitters. And that went pretty well for the first few years in Oakland. Mm-hmm. But what happened in 2010 was, oh, wow, this thing is spiraling and it literally doesn't matter how, you know, positive I think, or, you know, all these things I was kind of grew up with, it's still miserable out here and I'm still sucking on the mound. So once that happened and I got left off the roster, and it literally at the same time, my father had a stroke and was in ICU and everything was falling apart. And so I was forced to just to really detach from that idea that, you know, baseball is a Barry is baseball. And this other thing kind of started bubbling up. But at that time, I mean, I would be lying if I, you know, if I said I was really hoping the team would go all the way and win the World Series, because I was in that dugout unable to play and I was just totally miserable. And again, it was all about me at that time. That's how selfish I was at that time. So it was a really turbulent thing, but something really beautiful came about from it.
I'm not sure how closely you're following current Giants narratives, Barry, but the latest on the ballpark, and we actually had Alex Pavlovich say on our air today, he thinks it's almost a done deal that they will move in the fences. As someone who pitched in that ballpark, which at least for now is advantageous to pitchers, you know, one of the thoughts is big hitters haven't wanted to come here because of what it might do to their home run numbers, but I'm thinking maybe you can provide us with the perspective from the other side of that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we all know that park is incredible to pitch in and that hitters don't want to go there. And, you know, we would be sitting there during batting practice, you know, behind the cage or, you know, whether it was Pablo hitting or, you know, Aubrey or Buster or whatever, and they would just absolutely tank a ball, you know, to left center, right center, dead center, and, you know, it was a can of corn out there, and we would all just be laughing, and, of course, they would be, you know, saying words under their breath about it. So I think that's something we all know. I think it's probably a good idea to move them in just a little bit. And at the end of the day, you don't know how a ballpark is going to play when you build it. I mean, you see it all the time. Some of these places, like Cincy or Philly, are a complete joke, you know, and, you know, San Francisco and some of these other ones are just a graveyard, and you actually, I feel like the engineers still haven't figured that out yet, you know?
Well, how has music helped you not make yourself the center of your universe? Or did you already reach that point before you started taking music as seriously as you have?
I did reach that point, yeah, before. I think, you know, like I said, 2010, I actually started going to the 12-step program back in L.A. when I got home after the World Series, kind of. And the idea was not so much alcoholism, but it was more about I can't control what other people think. And it was called codependency, CODA. And that really opened my eyes to, like, you know, hey, there's this thing out there greater than me, and it's going to give me a lot of peace to believe in that. And so I never fully believed in things like that growing up. Was very much raised in an Eastern kind of tradition, Eastern religion, closely tied to. So that's kind of when the change happened for me. It was 2011. And so since then, you know, even 2012 included, it's just been like, hey, you know, whatever you want, God, I'm just over here working my butt off, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And I think that is a completely different thing that than I had my entire life. So now I'm just loving music and enjoying just, you know, trying to be in gratitude every day for the ability to enjoy music.
Well, you sound great, Barry, for sure. And we're looking forward to Curveball. Barry Zito's memoir will be out September 17th, barnesandnoble.com. Let me ask you this. If you had the opportunity to do it all over again, would you still sign with the San Francisco Giants?
Absolutely. Yep, I would. I can't. I mean, I've actually thought about this a lot, but I feel like if I re-signed with the A's, let's just say everything went perfect, ended up, you know, going pitching 20 years and winning 300 games, I probably would still be a completely lost person and still looking for my identity somewhere, you know, out on the streets of Hollywood or San Francisco. So I think all the adversity really helped me, and I wouldn't change a thing.
So quickly, just as a musician, who is the person that you would be the most thrilled, the most over the top for if you get a call tomorrow, hey, could you come in and lay down some guitar and vocal for this track with me?
Stevie Wonder, for sure.
Nice.
Not bad.
Great choice.
No, that was the correct answer.
That is the right answer.
You move on to the
great job.
Excellent.
Very nice, Ray. I'm glad.
Hey, well, good stuff, Barry. You sound like you're in a great spot, man. And I know Giants fans and Ace fans will be thrilled to hear from you on 95.7 The Game. And we'll be looking forward to Curveball. Hey, just quickly, the Curveball, like, I mean, the 12-6, it's like art, man. It's beautiful. When you were in form, watching that thing drop off the plate, like, well, just quickly, how did you perfect that pitch? And when did you know you had it so damn good?
Man, it sounds crazy, but I learned that pitch from a Tom Seaver book called The Art of Pitching when I was 7, and I actually gripped the ball the wrong way because there was only right-handed pitchers of how to throw the pitch, so I just gripped it left-handed, but I ended up holding my curveball completely different than anybody I ever met my whole life, and maybe that was it, I don't know, but I think it was throwing it from the age of 7 that really helped me.
Good stuff. Well, hey, man, we'll be looking forward to Curveball, barnesandnobles.com, and continued success, Barry, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks so much, fellas.
All right, good stuff from Barry Zito, and we do appreciate him joining us, and I hope you enjoyed that replay, that special encore presentation here from the Dame and Brooke Show. All right, we've been waiting with bated breath. I know Elena was waiting. Matt, you were going to ask Ray something, and then we had to go to break, and then we played the replay, so this is like a half-hour tease. Now it's time to pay it off.
I hate to tell you.
What were you going to ask Ray Ratto?
I hate to tell everybody this. We sort of worked it out in the break, but what I was going to ask him is it fair? Well, this is actually illustrative, and I can do it without forcing Ray to engage, which is probably good for everybody. My question was going to be, is it fair to call Trent Taylor injury prone? Because we've debated when it's okay. At what point has someone established themselves as injury prone? And then as I started to think about exactly how to present the question and also imagine Ray's snarky answers, I actually looked at Trent Taylor's career. And the fact is, he was drafted in 2017. This will be his third season as a professional football player. And Trent Taylor, while in my head he's injury prone, in two seasons of potential availability has played 29 out of 32 games. So the answer is no, it's not fair to call Trent Taylor injury prone. That said, it feels to me like we've been hearing about minor injuries his entire career. And I'm positive that a back injury was used as excuse, reason, whatever you want to call it, for his lack of production last season after probably more than expected production as a rookie, which granted was only 430 yards, but fifth rounder who grabs 43 balls for you, you feel pretty good about that.
Sure.
Second year guy who only grabs 26 for 215 total yards, they used a back injury to explain that, and now he's missing the first few games of this season after foot surgery. I don't know. That's a high percentage of his games where an injury has had an effect. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because I don't think it's pejorative.
Yeah, it's just a fact.
I mean, yeah, I mean, just it saying that he has not played X number of games out of X number of games is simply a statistic.
Right.
Injury prone, though, to me sounds condescending. And I think in most cases, players get hurt not because they failed at their manhood test, but because football is a hyper-violent game played by hyper-violent men who don't mind hurting you. And so when you get hurt, is that a measure of your character or a measure of the game? And I would suggest that far more often it's a measure of the game.
And I also think, just to sort of tack on to that, yes, it's a measure of the game. Certainly, I think we can all agree that there are people in the world who, if we line up 50 people and have them all take the same contact, some people will be hurt more than others. Where I think I end up siding with Ray almost every time is that...
And you say this with such sadness in your voice.
Resignation.
I can't, because, I can't really avoid it in this case. Usually I'm happy to agree with Ray. I contest that I am usually chagrined. But in this case, I think you never or very rarely have enough of a sample to call someone truly injury prone at the NFL football level because there's so much contact that rises to a level of that's going to hurt 9 out of 10 or at least 8 out of 10 guys who deal with it. There's just not a lot of scenarios where guys are hurt by something that would only hurt 2 out of 10 people in the, if we lined them all up and had them take the same hit, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like the bar that guys are getting hit at is above the bar that they'd be injury prone. If everyone was taking slight contact and half the guys were getting injured from that slight contact, well, then there's half the guys are kind of injury prone because other guys don't get hurt when they take that kind of hit. But there's so much violent contact in the NFL that more often than not, when guys get hurt, there's scenarios where almost anyone who was in that situation would have gotten hurt. So how do you call that guy injury prone?
And to me, injury prone is always used when, well, he's not available to me right now.
Yeah.
Well, why is he not available to you? Oh, because he got his transfers process shattered 3 weeks ago. You know, and it's and coaches always sort of view that as a failing of the person getting hurt,
which oftentimes it is not.
Yeah, so you know, it just I don't know. To me, there are an awful lot of amateur coaches out there and amateur general managers who look at a guy and say, "Well, he just doesn't want it bad enough." Well, shut up. You wouldn't be in camp if you didn't want it badly enough.
Yeah. That's like saying, you know, in totally different context, but like saying, oh, this guy sucks or that guy sucks. No, he's a pro athlete.
Right.
And you're a dude on your couch. He doesn't suck by, you know, actually, if the standard is who sucks and who doesn't,
you
he
suck.
Absolutely does not suck.
Yeah, you're the one who sucks.
And you do.
Yep. Or maybe you don't suck at something, or maybe you suck at something that you would never do anyway, so you don't really suck.
That's right.
I mean, the point is, a player sucks only when compared to other players at his position and circumstance.
Right.
And,
but that's the nature of sports verbiage, isn't it? It's
well,
all
it is,
hyperbole.
But,
and
yeah, but most of the people who use sports verbiage aren't saying, well, relative to player X, player Y sucks. It's no, player Y sucks. He shouldn't be on the team. Well, you're no judge of that. You know, it's why fans should be shot.
Quickly. Whoa, easy. By the way, this
segment... Okay, just wounded.
This segment sponsored by Free...
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.